The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Listening to the opening theme to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and also my voice, and I'm Timothy Harvey, and I'm sitting across from Mr. Jason Hunt.
Yes.
And this is your latest episode of H2O, where we have the sad, responsibility or experience of discussing losing the composer of that theme.
James Horner.
Who we just learned. We are recording this on a Tuesday, and yesterday we learned that James Horner unfortunately died in a plane crash. And
and really strange circumstances. Apparently, he was an avid pilot, same as Harrison Ford,
right?
And this plane was registered in his name. We knew that much when the plane went down, about 60 miles north of Santa Barbara, California. And the FAA incident report was very, very basic, very terse, didn't have any details on it at all except for the type of plane, and it went down and where the location was, and there were no survivors. And for the longest time, people were wondering if Horner was actually on the plane.
Right.
Because nobody could confirm where he was, and his lawyer had basically come out and said, yes, it's his plane. No, I haven't heard from him. If he hadn't been on the plane, I would have gotten a call by now.
Right.
And then his assistant, sometime, I guess Tuesday morning, maybe, posted on Facebook, basically confirmation that Horner was on the plane. We still don't have official coroner identification because, not to get into too many details, you know, ugly details here, but apparently the body was pretty badly,
as it is often the case.
Caused not only the plane crash, but also it caused a fire.
Right.
So who knows how much damage was done after the fact. But there was a small brush fire, and they had to put that out, and they had to recover the body of the pilot. So the coroner is doing an autopsy, and they're doing the identification process now as we're recording. When we release this episode, probably we'll have confirmation that it was in fact James Horner who was flying the plane.
Yeah,
61 years old. His career spanned quite a bit of our teens and 20s, our formative years.
Well, he got his first real big score was The Lady in Red in 78. So,
and then he did Roger Corman's Battle Beyond the Stars.
And also Humanoids from the Deep, if you want to go with the B movies.
Yeah.
And then Wolfen in 81.
See, I didn't remember he did Wolfen. I knew about Battle Beyond the Stars.
But Wolfen is the one that kind of got his name out to
right.
the people.
Because that was a more legitimate film.
Right. Well, yeah, well, I like Wolfen.
Compared to Battle Beyond the Stars.
Which is a guilty pleasure film of mine. And I always enjoy
basically a Star Wars ripoff.
Oh, God, yes.
Richard Thomas
right.
as the Luke Skywalker analog. Yeah.
Which, if you've ever asked yourself, what would it be like if John Boy went to space? The answer is there. And what would it be like if the Magnificent Seven? Because it's essentially, not only is it a Star Wars ripoff, it's a Magnificent Seven ripoff.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so much fun. I mean, it is so cheesy bad. But at the same, and it's that wonderful period of filmmaking where if you didn't have any money, you recycled footage from other films.
Mm-hmm.
And
is it cheesy bad, like deliberately cheesy bad, like Flash Gordon?
There's an element of self-awareness to it. Yeah, there's they knew how much money they had, and they knew what they were doing, and so there's a certain you can look at it and go yeah they knew what they were doing.
I was in Best Buy the other day, and I almost picked up Flash Gordon on Blu-ray, and I thought I'll have to come back. And
see,
get
I would have done that.
I would have picked it up. Well, I was getting ready for a trip.
Well, no,
and
sure.
So you know, you prioritize what you're going to spend because you know you got to spend money down at Smallville Comic Con.
You can skip a meal.
I do frequently. Wait, are you saying I'm fat? That I need to skip a meal?
So the other films he's worked on. He did Wolfen, and he did Deadly Blessing, which was a Wes Craven movie.
Yep.
Which I cannot recommend. it's not very.
How do you have time to see all of these films?
It wasn't when I was in college. This is one of the things that I miss about being in college was that a ridiculous amount of free time you always seem to have.
Yeah.
And you would.
I don't remember having a lot of free time.
We had friends, it was during the summer. We'd come home from summer. We'd have a summer job.
Sure.
And we had the friend who worked at the video store. This is back in the day when there was the mom-and-pop video stores.
Those of you who are young, and turn to the older person next to you and say, what was a video store?
Video stores were actual buildings where they kept the videos.
And a video in those days was a black box with a spools of shiny brown film in it that was spun from one spool to the next spool,
wow.
And it had a signal on it that you could watch the video.
And if you had lots of money, you could get a Laserdisc, which was like a DVD only five times as big.
I still have my Laserdisc of the Star Wars trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And Star Trek VI.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've got Star Trek II. I do have Star Trek II on Laserdisc. Yeah.
Do you still have a Laserdisc player?
I do.
Oh,
and
good.
It still works.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, I actually should pull those out sometime and just sit and watch them.
Yeah.
I can see, and we've talked about this before on The Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. Whenever I watch it on VHS, there's one point in the movie where I know this is where I had to flip the Laserdisc over. Every single time.
Right.
And every single time I watch it, that pops into the back of my head, just completely unbidden, and I don't even think about it. It's
so
just
if you're going to think about it, you might as well just do it.
But I'm like... Yeah, and it's the point where R2 and Luke are talking about meeting up with everybody, and he says, "No, I have a promise to keep to an old friend." And the shot where the X-wing goes away from the camera,
that's the cut.
That scene is the beginning of the side two for the disc.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I don't know why I remember that all the time.
Well, because you used to watch it. Well, and the thing is that's one of the reasons that I know a lot of these films is that we would sit there and go, we would go down to the video store and we'd rent like handfuls. And we just walk through the horror section and the science fiction section and the comedy section.
Mm.
And this is also a big time where the comedy concert had exploded.
Oh, right.
So we would go through and we just grab handfuls of things and we just like watch them one after the other until like 2 or 3 in the morning. And then get up and go to work the next morning
because we were young
and we could do that. There'd be alcohol involved a lot of the time too.
I told Allie earlier today not to get old. And
there's a song in there somewhere.
But if you do get old, drink a lot of water.
Oh God,
I'm finding that.
Okay.
Have we gone off the rails?
Do we never go off the rails? But yeah. So back to James Horner. Which is, you know,
not to seem irreverent or anything, but we do, you know, you don't want to get maudlin when you talk about this kind of thing.
But you also want to, I think, we talk about this from time to time on the show, is that some things seem to be linked to specific times in how they were telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, to a certain degree,
because Jason and I are roughly the same age, like we're really a few months apart, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're three months behind me.
Yeah. And the thing is that we actually had the good fortune. I'm going to maintain till, you know, forever that we've had the good fortune. We got to be there when we got Superman and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And
we can claim first generation status.
We saw it with real eyes and theaters. But that actually is something that makes it really interesting, because you look at somebody like James Horner's career, and yeah, I mean, Humanoids of the Deep and Battle Beyond the Stars. I watched these on video in like probably 88, 89.
Yeah.
Which means, you know, they were probably, well, actually, you know, I probably watched Humanoids on the Deep on TV.
Yeah. Cuz Star Trek VI was 1986, Star Trek II, rather was 1986.
Right. So basically you Star Trek II was 82.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So but Wolfen is what got the attention of the folks over at Paramount when they were looking to, because they didn't want to use the same score from Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Right.
And they also didn't want to spend the money that they had spent on Star Trek the Motion Picture, which...
Right, because it was a unique set of circumstances, because Star Trek II was made by the television division of Paramount, not the motion picture group. Which at the time was highly unusual.
Well,
and probably now would still be looked kind of sideways and like, wait, who's making this film?
Well, and what? I think we look at how a studio goes about making a film is kind of like learning how sausage gets made. I mean, it's like it may taste yummy, but do not stare directly at the process, because the process can be pretty ugly. And some of the backstory of Wrath of Khan was that they did not, you know, they kicked Roddenberry out, essentially. They kicked him upstairs to be, you know, creative consultant. And I think it was an executive producer slot he ended up with that was, you know, a shut up gene was what it
pretty much
was. And they pulled in Harve Bennett. And to some degree, I think it could be argued that Harve Bennett, actually, to a lot of degree, it could be argued that Harve Bennett saved Star Trek. Because Gene Roddenberry, for all the fact that he is responsible for Star Trek, had a tendency to let big ideas get in the way of story. And if you've ever read the novelization of Star Trek the Motion Picture, there's some interesting sidetrack things in there. You're going, okay, I don't care.
Yep.
Give me back to the Enterprise. I don't know. What do you would telepathic human evolution? I don't care. Give me back to the story. And the bloated budget of Star Trek the Motion Picture. Although if you can pick up the director's cut.
The director's cut
is so
wonderful.
Good.
Yes.
It's one of those, even if you don't like commentaries.
I'm glad.
Listen to the commentary on that film.
Yeah,
it's great.
I am so glad that they got to finish that before Robert Wise died.
Oh, I know.
That he finally gets his movie done.
Yeah, that's another example of if you've behind the scenes, you may have a really huge name as a director, but the studio ultimately controls everything that happens with the film. Right. And
that's actually what James Horner ran into with Aliens, to bring it kind of back to topic, where he was talking about, I saw an interview with him where he was talking about the fact that he went over to England to meet with James Cameron and visit the set and start work. And he figured he'd have 6 weeks. And they were still shooting and changing things and shooting and changing things and shooting and changing things. And, you know, James Cameron being James Cameron, he is a extremely hands-on perfectionist that is never satisfied with anything. So they're always constantly redoing it. And I think it got to the point where He was writing and recording the last bits of his score something like 3 or 4 days before they had to record it with the orchestra. And Horner ended up cribbing from his own scores for Star Trek II, Star Trek III, in order to finish the Aliens soundtrack, the Aliens score. And I remember the first time I saw Aliens. And hearing the Klingon theme throughout Aliens, I thought, wait a minute. And I think that was one of the first times that I sat and realized that for good or ill, composers have a signature style.
Sure.
And I noticed it then with Horner. I know you can recognize, I'm going to date myself, you can pretty much pick out John Williams, James Horner, Alan Silvestri.
Yeah.
Jerry Goldsmith, not as easily.
No, but if you look at the, if you were to look at
Goldsmith did a lot before he did Star Trek.
I think that if you look at Goldsmith's stuff as the body of the work, if you look at his total body of work, you would recognize recurring themes.
Probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was one of those. Hang on. That's hang on. And I actually I will admit my as a musician myself, my respect for Horner as a composer went down because of that. And I thought, what's he doing? And then to hear the Rocketeers score,
right,
which had some of those same elements, you know, the suspense, you know, three note signature thing that he had in Star Trek II. Shows up in Rocketeer, and I'm like, hang on, he's just using the same thing over and over and over again. What? Why do they keep hiring this guy? And it wasn't until Patriot Games that I started to appreciate his work a little bit more, because Patriot Games actually didn't sound like Star Trek II or Star Trek III or the Rocketeer, and I think that some of that was probably the fact that you had so much of an Irish influence in the story, then you'd have more of that influencing the music. And I think that gave him a different direction to go with the score. But, you know, Willow had some of those same bits. All of the stuff from the 80s and the early 90s, all the stuff that James Horner did, there were pieces in each of those scores that could have been lifted from others.
Oh, well, yeah. People pointed out that he used elements from Prokofiev, from Schumann, from Wagner. But we've talked about this to before in the broader context of talking about remakes, and that we've been doing that since we've been telling stories. It's the same thing with musicians. In many, many ways, this is something that actually they've been recycling themes, and they've been pulling pieces from other stuff and ripping each other off, more or less, because that's kind of how art works. I mean, you know,
I suppose.
Well, from the best.
Yeah. Well, and I'll admit that I did a composition my senior year in high school, for a 42 piece wind ensemble. You know, my high school band, and there were pieces there that I, in retrospect, recognized that I'd lifted from Star Trek the Motion Picture, subconsciously. You know, I hadn't really sat there and said, okay, I'm going to make it sound like Goldsmith. But, you know, you start putting elements in, and then when you actually hear it for the first time, after you pick yourself up off the floor, because, you know, it's cool. You know, I've got a complete 42-piece wind ensemble playing my music.
Sure.
It was a wild experience, very surreal. But then after I started listening to it critically, I started hearing things, oh, that's Star Trek. Oh, I shouldn't have put that in there.
Right.
But there was this one part with the oboe that I didn't even realize was in there, and it was just such a pretty piece. And I thought, oh, that's a nice surprise. and it made me appreciate more the amount of work that goes into composing music.
Oh, sure.
Especially for you write a song for a band, you're, what, five, six pieces?
Mm, sure.
Instrument-wise. You're writing for a full orchestra. And you've got all of this stuff that you have to keep track in your head. It's like, well, okay, if the strings are doing, you know, the violins do this and the violas do this and the bass do this, and it's very, very difficult to hear all of that in your head.
Oh, sure. It takes real skill to play the entire orchestra in your mind.
And it
these
is.
Guys do it.
Yes.
But also bear in mind, I think we have to be acknowledge the fact that he did over 100 film scores.
Oh yeah, yeah, and, very prolific.
And I think no matter what, there's going to be bound to be a certain amount of repetition and stealing from yourself.
Sure.
When you're doing 100 different film scores.
Well, John Williams does it a little
bit. Oh, sure.
Bit.
Well, yeah.
Although it's not as recognizable when Williams does it. Williams doesn't necessarily do the same musical signatures as he does instrumentation groups.
Sure. And Williams has also had the accusation of ripping off Holst.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, think that, you know, and I think it's a little unfair.
And Born Free.
Yeah, I think it's a little unfair for. I mean, it's you can certainly make the argument that you know you're borrowing or adapting or ripping off, but at the same time you look at, and we see this in films too. You can definitely tell when someone is inspired by another filmmaker and they're trying to imitate their style or they've absorbed enough of their style to sit there and go, oh, De Palma. Okay, De Palma built an entire career about wanting to be Hitchcock.
Sure.
J.J.
Abrams did it with Super 8, basically trying to make a Spielberg film.
Well, but he set out to do that. It wasn't like, you know, he accidentally made one. We all sat there and went, wait a minute. It's like, no, it was very clear that this was
hold
like,
on.
This is, I'm making a Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
One can
hope that he's taking that same approach on The Force Awakens and saying, I'm making a Star Wars movie.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't say making a Lucas movie.
Well, because there's a difference between the Star Wars movies.
Oh, sure.
The first trilogy and the Lucas trilogy. Because
the
Lucas trilogy, that's the ones where nobody told him no.
Right. Yeah, I think,
you know,
yeah.
Unlimited resources doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a great film. We talked about that before. But
I hope
Abrams knows enough.
He does. I am not concerned. I think all the pieces are there.
But the score is going to be great.
The only concern I have is that we all are so excited that he could roll out a really, really amazing movie. And by the fact that we all want magic,
expectations are too high.
Yeah, and that we may get a really, really fantastic film, but it wasn't perfect and made of candy.
Yes.
You know, and it's like,
why are the stormtroopers look like that again?
Yeah,
somebody will find one thing to pick about.
And you know what? I think that we may have to find that person and bludgeon them to death. To make them stop and let us just enjoy the film. No, we won't do that. That's not very nice.
We could.
I'm just not. We're not going to tell you that we did it. Oh. It'll be a mysterious crime. But okay. So Star Trek II. So he. This is the film that basically gets him noticed.
Yeah.
And this is the film that basically revives. Because as much as the director's cut of Star Trek the Motion Picture is a really tight, solid, space. Highbrow,
science, very intellectual,
very intellectual very, science
very
fiction
man's
film. And the director's cut is the edit makes it zip. It doesn't
yeah,
feel draggy.
It's much better
as the theatrical release did. But really questionable whether or not there was going to be a second Star Trek. There were a lot of reasons to, you know, the studio was not happy about the budget and all these different things. And yet it worked. We get Nicholas Meyer.
Well,
we have
this
score. We have all the things.
I remember seeing an interview with George Takei early on, and this was archive footage where they were talking about the success of the first film and why go back? You guys are making it was back when they were doing Star Trek II. And somebody was talking about, oh, hey, you know, how's it feel to come back? And Takei was like, well, of course we're going to come back. You know, they made the first movie and it made a ton of money.
Yeah.
And the studio was happy and they said, let's do it again. And that's almost a quote. I remember him saying, it made a ton of money. And for all of the expense.
Oh, sure.
yeah, it made a ton of money, but now you've got all these sets that are standing mm-hmm. that you can use again. Mm-hmm. You have all of this optical footage, all these special effects footage that you can use again. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. If you go in and you look at Star Trek II, almost every shot that's not involving the Reliant mm-hmm. is all reused footage.
Yeah, but it doesn't register. It hasn't no. the first when you first saw that in the theater, it didn't register.
Because it's completely out of context from the first movie.
Sure.
I mean, leaving dry dock, sure, it's going to be the same thing because you're leaving dry dock. Yeah, I mean, what are like, you
going to do? How many shots can you... But yeah. I think that it ended up being... And a lot of it was tone, mm-hmm. and a lot of it was the music.
Yeah.
And I think that...
And the music gave it that nautical feel,
mm-hmm. which was part of what
Nicholas Meyer was going for yeah. with that Horatio Hornblower type mm-hmm. of picture.
Well, when you go to the big battle scenes, that cutting back and forth, and I listened to the score to the battle of the Mutara Nebula, mm-hmm. And by itself, I have no visuals. I'm in the car and I'm listening to this, and you realize how quickly. It changes. It's like it's Khan, Kirk, mm-hmm. Khan, Kirk, and it's bouncing back and forth. And then exterior shot of the Enterprise, and I'm
you see it.
I'm
in your head.
Watching it in my
yes.
head.
It's
all based on the music because I sit there and go, well, that's this shot, and that's this shot, and that's this shot. And
Khan and Kirk both had their own signatures.
That's right.
And you bounce it back and forth. And I mm-hmm. remember sitting there and listening to it because I would listen to it in the car too. And from the time of the I don't like to lose mm-hmm. all the way through. I know exactly line for line where all of the dialogue happens in that music.
Oh, sure.
Because you know the timing of the music. And the music is just, you're right. It plays out in your head mm-hmm. and you can see this.
Yep.
What does that say about us? How many times we've watched this movie?
Yes, we've watched it a lot. This is true. But at the same time, it's what a score is supposed to do.
Yeah.
A score, if you listen to that score, you're supposed to be able to evoke the images. And even if you took, you go back to classical music, which was in, you go to some of the great composers, they were telling stories. And they had no, there was no dialogue. There was no chorus. There was no... there was no aria. It was just they were telling the story through the instruments. Mm-hmm. Remember going when you were a kid to... Remember going when you were a kid to a concert and hearing Peter and the Wolf? I mean, just as an example, it's like you go to...
Yeah.
And that entire... it's just... Yes, you often had the narrator going, and then Peter went down to,
Right, but the music stands by itself without the narration,
and so that's what a score is supposed to do. Whether it's a orchestral piece or just a movie score mm-hmm. or
And James Horner had said in an interview one time, and I think it was with the Los Angeles Times back in 2009. I think I ran across this in my research that his approach was always to look at a scene. Mm-hmm. And try to figure out what all the characters were feeling at the time. Mm-hmm. What's mm-hmm. the emotion of the scene, and what should the audience be feeling? And what kind of emotions should the audience be experiencing at this point? And crafting the music to evoke all of that.
Right.
And not only to backstop the story, but to reinforce the emotional aspects of the scenes and bring out an emotional reaction from the audience. Mm-hmm. Speaking of reactions, emotional reactions, superherostuff.com gives us emotional reactions.
Because they have a lot of cool stuff.
Open up the box. So, look, here's some cool stuff. Which, before the night is over,
we have to order more stuff.
We've got to put our order together.
That's true.
All right. That was a really, really, really awkward transition right into stuff. But
superherostuff.com is a sponsor of this very show.
Yes. So we do mention them.
And we like them. They have a really cool website. You should go check it out because they do, in fact, have lots of cool, not just superhero stuff.
They've got all sorts of licensed merchandise from Godzilla and Star Wars and Doctor Who and DC Comics and Marvel Comics and Transformers and other stuff.
Other stuff.
other stuff. And cool stuff. And so we are going to let you hear from them. We're going to refill our coffee mugs and take a real quick break and be back with more discussion of James Horner, his career, and the influence he's had on us.
Yeah.
When H2O continues. Stand by.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Where can you get Age of Ultron stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Justice League stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Doctor Who stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
Where can you get Daredevil stuff?
SuperheroStuff.com.
New items being added all the time. Get your superhero stuff at SuperheroStuff.com. Plus, the Hero Box is back. $70 worth of superhero stuff for only $49. SuperheroStuff.com, where heroes shop.
Hi, this is Jason Hunt, and if you're one of the dedicated listeners for this show, first of all, thank you. Second, you are sharing with others, are you not? And you should be aware by now, we have many shows as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio, our Marvel discussion on Level 1187, the DC chat on the Rogues Gallery, Sci-Fi for Chicks talking about various topics, which we also do in mixed company on the Echo Chamber, and H2O, which is our one-on-one discussion between Mr. Harvey and myself, now syndicated over at Amazing Stories Magazine. Sci-Fi for Me Radio is more than one show, and we'd like to invite you to join us for all of it, or at least try it out and see what you think. And also check out Sci-Fi for Me TV, that's our YouTube channel, where we have interviews, convention panel video, and Week in Review, where we deliver a digest of the news of the week. All part of giving you the most bang for your buck. Oh yeah, wait, no, it's free. So check it out, Sci-Fi for Me Radio and Sci-Fi for Me TV, all part of SciFiForMe.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio. To do anything else would be highly illogical.
It makes me feel so crazy when I can't give perfection because of some stupid superimposed schedule that has nothing to do with the filmmakers. It has only to do with marketing department. And it's so difficult sometimes. And you have to be very clever to work around that. Aliens was very early on in my career. Titanic wasn't. And you mellow with age. I think Jim's mellowed, and I've certainly mellowed. And that all helps the process.
There is a pretty impressive catalog here that I think we just want to touch on real quick. We talked about Star Trek II. Really, really got his... the name James Horner out there. But we also have Gorky Park. And if you're of a certain age...
I didn't know he did that one.
Gorky Park, Uncommon Valor, Star Trek III, Cocoon, Volunteers, Commando, Aliens, Name of the Rose, An American Tale, Project X, Batteries Not Included, Willow, Red Heat, The Land Before Time, Cocoon, The Return, Field of Dreams, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Glory, Another 48 Hours, My Hero's Always Been Cowboys, The Rocketeer, American Tail, Fievel Goes West, of course, Sneakers.
That was such a good movie.
That is such a good movie. Unlawful Entry, Patriot Games, Swing Kids, which is a film that came out when I was in college, and great, great music in that film.
Wasn't that a musical?
No, it was set in the 40s and or the 30s in Germany.
Okay.
And House of Cards, the movie, not the TV show. Hocus Pocus, Searching for Bobby Fischer, Man Without a Face, Pelican Brief, Clear and Present Danger, Legends of the Fall, Braveheart.
And Braveheart is the score that got him talking to James Cameron again.
That's
to do
right.
Titanic.
Apollo 13.
Mm-hmm.
Great score on the movie.
It is.
Jumanji. Ransom. Devil's Own. Titanic. Deep Impact. Of all the films about an asteroid destroying the Earth, the only one that's any good. Sorry. those of you who are fans of a certain horrible movie. Mask of Zorro. Perfect Storm. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. He has to have one that's not good.
Now.
I just don't like that movie. Yeah. Enemy at the Gates, A Beautiful Mind, House of Sand and Fog, Troy, The Forgotten, Legend of Zorro, All the King's Men, Apocalypto, Spiderwick Chronicles, Avatar, little film. Amazing Spider-Man. He did the first Mark Webb directed Spider-Man film.
Yep.
And did not come back for the second one. He was not a fan.
Mm.
He did not like how it turned out, so he said, no, thank you.
Well, and he was in the process.
Four different films.
Of working on, he's got other films that are mm-hmm. completed and are on their way. But he was in the process of working on the next two or three, depending on which story you read, Avatar movies with Cameron. He was going to come back and do those.
Oh, sure. And I skipped over a bunch of films.
Oh, yeah.
I skipped over.
Yeah, he's done a ton of stuff. And it's interesting, you look at how prolific he was as a composer. And, you know, you look at all of the stuff he did in the 80s and 90s, and there were a lot of them that were of a piece.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And nowadays, not so much. His later work, and he's even, I ran across an interview he did in December, the fact that he says he can be a little bit more choosy now.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah. And he doesn't want to do the paint by numbers, follow the formula that a lot of films seem to be doing. And that actually goes into a point that you were making during the break, is the fact that, well, you make the point.
Well, I just, you, okay, look, there's how films are made, what the kind of films we get to see, it changes over time. All right. So we have you could argue very strongly that, the filmmaking periods of the 40s are different than the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 2000s and blah, 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 right?
Right.
So, and that's a good or for ill. You know, you can sit there and go, well, movies were better when I was a kid. Get off my porch.
Well, we get to see the movies we had when I was a kid because they're making them over again.
That's right. Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
But at the same time, is you have to recognize that certain films are made during certain periods of time and they're made that way, right? I mean, it's just a film is going to very much evoke the period it was made. And some films are going to be timeless. And some films are going to go, that was clearly made in the 1970s. But music, there's something that we seem to have stepped aside from. And I'm hoping it's a temporary phase. Because you don't get those big iconic scores anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Avengers score sound like?
Mm-hmm.
What does the Star Wars score sound like?
Well, now the Star Wars score, you could immediately know what it is.
Okay, but what is it? Okay, what is what does the...
Now the Avengers score, I could probably, if I really sat and thought about it, because I've seen it enough times that I could probably come up with.
Well, there's not
like you said, there's not signature motifs.
Yeah.
For
so what's
and the, there might be, but they could be subtle.
What's the Iron Man score? What's the big hook from the Iron Man score?
Black Sabbath.
Okay, there we go. what's the big hook from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man score?
Well, couldn't tell you.
I know, and that's I think that's something that we've
and if I could sing it for you, I wouldn't.
Yeah, well, and we're thankful for that. But
yeah.
but you look at something like Star Wars or you know the Christopher Reeves Superman, or the
Jaws,
or the Tim Burton Batman movies, not the later films as much as the Tim Burton ones, those first two.
Although the Tim Burton one had the advantage of getting reinforced by being used in the animated show.
Oh, sure, but at the same time, you end up with a theme. I mean, yes, the Nolan Batman films have a theme. Okay,
yeah.
and you will recognize it. If you hear it, you go, oh, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've had one Man of Steel movie, one of the new Superman films, and the score, the Zimmer score is okay.
Yeah, I mean
the hook is all right, but it's not, it doesn't have, and it's, I don't, it's not a function of, to me, looking at it and looking at the rest of this, it's less about, you know, it's less about not having, them getting it wrong. It's just that we're not even getting that anymore.
The Man of Steel score fails because it doesn't have the triptych.
Well, it should
every,
have the triptych.
Every Superman score up until that point has some version of the triptych.
Well, yes, I agree. It should have the triptych.
This one doesn't, and it is it completely loses me.
I think
this is just such a boring score.
Well, and I think, unfortunately, we're not getting those. We're just, overall, we're not getting them. The current trend in movie making is not to have these big, iconic soundscapes. And I think that's a really, they're missing out on something there.
Yeah, and I hope that in December, that's going to turn around.
Well,
December 18th.
Oh, well.
That's going to turn around.
Oh, but see, here's the thing. Because
people are going to see Star Wars, mm-hmm. and they're going to think, oh, that's what we need to be doing.
Okay.
And they'll try to emulate they did it before.
But that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Because if you think about it, we heard they're making a new Star Wars movie. And we all sat there and went, uh-huh, tell me more. And then we got more information. The original cast has come back. And we're like, tell me more.
Yeah.
And then, okay, it's like, okay, good. Oh, my God, okay, this all sounds really good.
And then we got word that John Williams is going to come back.
And we're like, okay. But up until that first trailer.
Yeah.
But you know what your throat did? The first time you saw it?
Mm-hmm.
You had that little catch in it?
Yep.
And maybe it teared up just a titch?
Yep.
Because it hit, I mean, once you got that, it had that emotional response. And so you get that. How do you feel when you hear the Indiana Jones theme?
Oh, yeah.
You kind of perk up because
on the teaser. On the teaser, for me, it was a combination. And we talk about this on Sci-Fi XY, the new episode, mm-hmm. which is dropping this week.
Yeah.
That blast of music in Star Wars, mm-hmm. that first smash of sound, that's what I remember seeing the movie for the first time in 1977.
Sure.
When the teaser hit, and I knew, I've got to see this on the big screen. I'm mm-hmm. not going to watch it online. I know it's online. I'm not going to watch it. We went and saw Big Hero 6 to mm-hmm. see the teaser.
Right.
It's a combination. The first thing that you see is the Millennium Falcon.
Sure.
That shot would not work as well as it did if it had had some other piece of music behind it.
Oh, yeah.
And that music, you know, sure, you're seeing the Millennium Falcon, that's fine, but it's hearing that music.
Right.
When it hits, when it does in the teaser, that's when you sit there and go, okay, it might be all right.
Right.
We might be okay.
Well, and I think you... Okay, if you listen to any kind of music, if you listen to pop music of any kind, if you listen to country music or jazz or blues or anything, there's an emotional response, okay?
Yeah. Yep,
and if you don't get an emotional response from music, I feel kind of bad for you.
You have no soul.
Because you're missing out on something. But I think that we all do. There's always something that sits there and goes, mm-hmm. yeah, that whatever it is, and it's tied to a moment in our lives or a film or a family member or something. There's an emotional hook, and the really best of composers sit there and go, you know, I do want the audience to feel like this right now. I want to give this, you know, one of the things, and things you do when you're wasting time, you got dead time in at work. I watched a comparison of Wrath of Khan, because I was on this, you know, following things down the YouTube rabbit hole.
Sure.
Comparison between Wrath of Khan and Star Trek Into Darkness, and the critical scenes of the death scenes, right? Spoiler alert for those of you who have avoided Star Trek Into Darkness, they flip the Kirk Spock the Spock death and make it a Kirk death, and it's just it's not necessary. But what they also managed to miss is, because it's not an earned death,
right?
There's nothing earned there emotionally, even though it's the second film in the series, just like in the second film. But you didn't have the TV show. You didn't have
You didn't have 30 years of history.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but what they also missed out on was, and there's nothing wrong with the new of Of all the complaints you could make about the new Star Trek films, the music's fine. It evokes. It's a new theme, but it evokes the TV show. It's what they've done. There's something wrong with the music.
When I was watching J.J. Trek, that was one of the things that I listened for. Mm. Is to say, okay, what is however you pronounce his name?
Right.
What is he going to do with the score? And it was okay. It went up until the point where it said Star Trek.
Mm.
Okay, I'm with you so far, you know, mm-hmm. because you had the attack on the Kelvin and right. you know, the sacrifice and George Kirk, and it's very emotional, and you sure. get this music, and then the rest of it just kind of fell flat.
Well,
of course, the rest of the movie fell flat, well, so that probably reinforced. But I listened to the music of the first Star Trek, you know, J.J. Trek, and I thought, this is boring.
See, I didn't have a problem with the music, but I think that you
it never evoked an emotional response for me.
Well, but you were also fighting against a different emotional response.
That's true. I hated the film.
You come with the history of watching the other films.
Yeah.
I didn't have a problem with the music, but you get into comparing the two. So when you have someone like Horner, who even at that early stage in his career was able to sit there and, you know, between the edit, obviously, between the performances and mm-hmm. all the, you know, the direction, all those things came together. And the music on top of that, to give you those moments where the emotional catch, where, you know, we know how some films, you know, horror films don't work without music.
Right.
You take the music out of a horror film, you're going, this is dumb.
Why are they going in the...
What? Are they yeah. stupid?
Why are they going upstairs? What?
It's like, where did that guy come from? Well, you didn't hear the teaser music, where you know, but
Jaws yeah. wouldn't work without the music.
No, so there's this. A lot of this stuff is critical, and when you get into a death scene, yeah, and don't misunderstand, silence, pulling the music out completely
mm-hmm.
can be extremely effective. But at the same time, so I'm watching these two things, and they're cutting back between the two.
Yeah.
So you see, you know, Captain, you better get down here. Both versions. It's like,
right.
and flips back. And I'm watching it, and I'm realizing two things. One, wow, the new Enterprise has got very few people on board. And I realize that in the second film, they evacuate engineering. But they lose something, because when you've got the crowd, you've got all those engineers around...
Yeah,
McCoy. You've got the Troika there. You've got the Troika and Scotty, who's kind of, you know, he's number four. He's yeah. the and so you end up with all the different emotional pieces are there that are just completely missing, because it's just Scotty, Kirk, and Spock in the darkness. So you lose. So I'm watching the visuals, and I had never actually thought about this. Is that, oh yeah. You've lost a visual cue there. You've lost a moment that you could have had where you, some of those emotional things that you could have given, they made that death feel a little more earned
yeah.
if you'd had it and you didn't have them. But the music, and I'm going,
mm-hmm.
Because it's not there. And I think that Horner, like Williams, like a lot of fantastic composers, understood very, very clearly that if you put the right sound underneath anything, you can sit there and reach out and grab hold of that heartstring and go pluck.
Although I remember reading somewhere that coming out of the funeral scene in Star Trek II,
mm-hmm.
you had Scotty playing the bagpipes, Amazing Grace on the bagpipes. Right,
which was Doohan's idea.
Yep. And I remember reading that Horner got told to continue Amazing Grace orchestrally afterwards when they fired the torpedo
sure.
off into
mm-hmm.
that and then use that as a transition to get back into Kirk in his quarters. He didn't want to do it because I seem to recall him being of the mind, it's either him or Nicholas Meyer talking about the fact, well, maybe it was Meyer that didn't want to do it, the fact that in Star Trek there was no religion. You know, people were not religious, and we didn't want to present that. It didn't strike me as being a religious thing more than it's a cultural thing. You know, Scotty's paying tribute to Spock. But I want to say that Horner didn't want to continue the music out of the ship.
Well, it's entirely possible, but and I think that.
But it works so well.
Oh, it does. But that whole everything there's whole portions of that tail end of the film that people didn't want it to be that way, and it was that way, and it worked.
Yeah.
You know, Meyer was you know very very clear that he had no intention of Spock coming back, and yet, you know, and was not happy. Initially,
wanted to take his name off the picture because of that last scene where they show the torpedo on the ground.
So it was, you know, and guess what? He was wrong. It was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I can see that, though. I think that, do you remember the story about him wanting to have a no smoking sign? And it's in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the turbo lift.
Well. It's in, and everyone's out there went, no one's going to smoke in 2300, whatever. He's like, they've been smoking for centuries. You think they're going to stop now? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, yeah. So then they still managed to take it down, and I don't know, they hid it from him or something. But, there's something about, you know, using Braveheart as an example, of course, and, you know, goes off and, you know, wins a whole bunch of Academy Awards, that film.
But not for music.
Not for music. But it was nominated.
Yeah. Yeah. Horner got 10 Oscar nominations throughout his career. Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to that soundtrack, it's another film that if you listen to that music on its own, you can sit there and go, and here's where the English charged, and here's where the Scots said, come get some.
And the Rocketeer's that way too.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's actually probably a good thing.
I remember listening. I got a hold of the soundtrack to the Blue Max, George Papard movie.
Wow, yeah,
a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which was actually done by Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah,
and I found myself listening to this and thinking, this sounds a lot like The Rocketeer. And it struck me, and I don't know if it was just because it was an aviation thing or what, but listening to the two, you can put them up side by side, and there are pieces of The Rocketeer that are evocative of the Blue Max.
Mm.
And it's funny, for the longest time after that movie came out, I had the soundtrack, and I listened to it all over and over and over and over again. Anytime I flew on a plane, I heard, that opening theme there, when they bring the plane out and he takes off for the first time in the opening
of
the movie.
Yeah.
I'm looking out the window and I can hear that music whenever we take off on a plane. And it was a subconscious thing. It wasn't
That's
anything that
thing,
I was,
though.
You
That's
know,
kinda cool.
doing on purpose. Just, because it reminds you.
Right.
You know, you get those moments where you get the reminder of, oh, I remember this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the music evokes memories of certain events or certain people, like you were saying. But on the flip side, you can turn it around, and certain things that happen to you, certain experiences that you have, pop up.
Oh, sure.
A piece of music
uh-huh.
that you've heard in a film score sometime, you know, in your past. And for me, it was Goldsmith, Horner, and Williams.
Yeah,
were the top three.
Well, and I think that says something right there, is that we have.
And that's probably true of a lot of people our age.
Well, sure, because these were the guys who basically created the sound. They created the sound to these movies. They created the sound to the. And again, it was a different time when you would build themes,
mm-hmm.
and it would be the theme to,
yep.
Superman, the theme to Star Trek, the theme to Gunsmoke. I mean, you know, there was a whole different way of looking at, it's like you could go buy the 45 of the theme of the of whatever it was.
I still have the main title theme to Star Trek II on a 45.
Sure. Yeah, but it was a different way of looking at things. And now it's, I think in many ways they're kind of looking at it as the whole score. Mm-hmm. They're treating it as a whole piece as opposed to this is, you know. And I think
I really hope Star Wars turns that around.
I honestly would like that. I think they're missing out on the opportunity to get stuff that you're just missing out on now because you don't have that emotional connection that maybe you get by having one, and you can refer back to that theme throughout the thing, and you've got that one piece that sits there and grabs you and goes, get excited.
Star Trek, the motion picture, Jerry Goldsmith, he had created all of this music, and Robert Wise comes in and he listens to it, and they're looking at stuff. It's like, it just is off. Something was off. Mm. And they sat and they just went around it in circles and circles for a while until Robert Wise came back and he said, there's no theme.
Mm-hmm.
And Goldsmith kind of sat for a minute. And, oh, you're right. Oh, that's a problem. Yeah. You know, I did this whole score and there's no theme.
Yeah.
And he basically had to redo most of what he had done because there was no signature theme like what you're talking about. And then now when you look at Star Trek the Motion Picture, you cannot watch that film without that music. You can't imagine any other music being there.
Well, it's like listening to, and I tend to think of, I mean, I almost tend to think of Star Trek II and Star Trek III is, I mean, they're two parts
they're
of the
piece.
Same.
Yeah, they're piece. Bookends.
And you can't imagine. Can you imagine listening to Ricardo Montalban threaten Kirk without that music?
Mm.
Can you imagine Kirk stealing the Enterprise without that music?
And I mean, the flow from Star Trek II to Star Trek III would be much different if they had gotten different composers.
Oh, God. That would almost be...
That would be too hard.
That would almost be jarring. Even if you're not watching them back-to-back, that would almost be jarring.
Now, they went to Star Trek IV with Leonard Rosenman.
Sure. But it's a different tone.
It's a completely different tone. Different style of film. And then, bringing Goldsmith back for V. I would have been curious to see what Horner would do with a Star Trek film now.
I think, honestly, I think that it would have been a different vibe. I think a lot of the criticisms that we would have for the two Abrams films would not be any less valid, but emotionally...
The music would have been better.
Emotionally, there might have been a different thing, because I think he was always really, really good at finding the emotion in the scene and saying, this is the music that goes with that.
Yep.
So, unfortunately,
we're not going to get that.
We're not going to get that anymore.
Well, we will get the four films that are coming out that he scored.
There's two documentaries. One is One Day in Auschwitz, Living in the Age of Airplanes, which is some great aviation music there. I think he's going to.
Oh, sure.
The 33 and Southpaw. And
now, Southpaw is the one that's coming up next, right?
They're both 2015, supposedly. Okay.
Yeah.
But the 33 is about the mining disaster, the Chilean mining disaster, which I imagine is going to have some really good emotional hooks for him to play with.
I expect so.
And then Southpaw is the boxing film with
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah,
I would expect that whoever takes over for the Avatar pictures will incorporate Horner's
first score into
pieces of that, at least.
I think it would be foolish to not do that because, again,
kind of like what they did with the Superman Returns, where you get some signature elements from the Williams score, and you get some original stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think that if you're going to make something that is a sequel to something else, and you are not recognizing the successes, what worked. No matter what it is, but certainly in music, then you're making your life harder. You're making it harder on your audience in a way that you just don't have to do. So it's a shame. I'm going to miss a lot of that music. We still have the music.
Yes.
But I'm going to miss the chance to hear more from him because it'd be interesting to see what he would do, obviously.
And we are going to make it easier on our audience and quit talking. that's going to do it for us. We certainly do. If you've got a favorite memory some you know comment that you'd like to make about the career of James Horner, you can certainly leave that. You can send us an email, h2o@sci-fi.com.
Or even just the music that
yeah, just what,
know, whatever what, music that, yeah, that what pieces inspires like. That to what, you. So yeah,
what makes you feel?
Yeah.
You can let us know. We certainly like to hear your comments. We read all of your comments and emails. Don't get enough of them. We'd like to have more of a dialogue with you guys out there. Also, we do encourage you to share these shows with your friends and fellow fans, you know, people that you think enjoy the genre who might enjoy listening to these shows.
I actually just did that.
Did you?
I did with one of my doctors.
Well.
Yes. She's a science fiction fantasy fan, well, turns out. So.
I was down in Hutchinson, well, Smallville, Kansas.
Sure,
for Smallville Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And had some of our business cards was passing some of those out and actually made a connection with a shop in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Oh.
So we'll see what kind of a connection that brings. But cool. So maybe some people up in Wyoming start listening to our shows somewhere.
Excellent.
That would be fun. As always, you can find us over on the social media. I'm not going to go through the list.
All the
social media except Facebook, or except MySpace. See, I did it. I knew I was going to.
We're not everywhere but MySpace, folks, just everywhere because we can't find MySpace. Ourselves a good enough reason to go back.
I can't find a good enough reason to do any of the ones that we've got, but, you know, we do anyway because we serve our audience, right?
Yep. Uh-huh. Sure.
Uh-huh. All right, that's going to do it for us. Allie Ulrich, our engineer over there, pushing the buttons.
Everybody smile and wave at Allie.
Yes. And we will be back next week with another episode of H2O. Timothy Harvey.
Pleasure, sir.
My name is Jason Hunt. For everybody here at Sci-Fi for Me, thanks very much for listening, and we will be back.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi For Me Radio.